Hello, and welcome to the Book Wars Pod, episode 31. I'm Kristen, I'm here with Kate and Chris, and we're trying to be very patient because we've already had a fuckload of technical difficulties tonight. We are reading the last 10 stories in the Star Wars book From a Certain Point of View, which is the stories There Is Another by Gary D. Schmidt, Through Wills by Tom Engelberger. And just to say up top, we all have seen The Last Jedi and have big feelings about it, but we will not be discussing those big feelings on this podcast. We are giving everybody until after the new year to go and do the things, and then I'm sure we will be referencing it pretty heavily in the podcast, considering we're reading Lost Stars and Phasma. So, before we get into it, what are you guys drinking tonight? What?
I really enjoy, like, all of our just, like, thinly simmering anger at, like, all of our technical issues tonight. We promise we did. This anger is not directed at The Last Jedi.
It's really not.
No, it's actually not.
But we'll get into that
book, and that's all we'll be saying about it.
Yep. Oh yeah, no, we're gonna talk much more about Last Jedi in the future.
Once people are maybe slightly less angry, but anyway.
In case anybody misinterprets this, I loved The Last Jedi. None of my anger is because of The Last Jedi. My anger is purely at computers. Continue. Yep.
All right. Same. So I am drinking. Okay, so Trader Joe's has this very deliciously named Christmas. It's not eggnog.
It's like vegan eggnog.
It's not even eggnog, though. Ooh. Yeah. It's literally called Chocolate Peppermint Almond Beverage, which is the least appetizing name ever, but it's actually delicious. And then I wanted to spike it, because obviously, but we don't have any brandy, so I was a disgusting person and just dumped a bunch of alcohol in it. And by alcohol, I mean vodka. So, great. We're gonna see how this goes.
Yeah, this could be dangerous.
I'm sure
we'll see
how it
goes.
Fine.
Could be. Probably is. Whatever.
What are you drinking, Chris?
I am drinking a Star Hill Snowblind Doppelbock, which is Star Hill Brewery's winter seasonal, and Star Hill from Charlottesville, Virginia. It is delicious.
Holy shit, guys, it's like 40% vodka, sorry.
Oh my god. Kate's already too drunk.
I love Doppelbock a lot. German beer is very good. I went to the beer store today, because I always do that. I always use the pod as an excuse to go to the beer store. So I am drinking an Ex Novo, Not Too Bright, which I have not had before. It's a New England style India Pale Ale. It comes in at 7%, and it's been double dry hopped with Galaxy, Citra, and Mosaic hops. So it smells really dank. I just opened it. It smells so dank.
Yum, yum.
Ex Novo is a Portland local brewery, started in 2012, I believe. And their whole thing is that they really like to give back to the community, so they actually, all of their, like, stuff is like, let's go volunteer together for shit.
So they give children beer.
They give children beer, that's what it says on their website.
Awesome, perfect.
Oh, yum. And, actually, I just drove by there earlier today. They have a nice brew pub, kind of just south of, Mississippi. The Mississippi corridor here in Portland. So they're nice people. I like them. And they make good beer. But without further ado, let's talk about... Oh, and I read the rest of this book when I was really sick last weekend. So I don't know what I remember. So as usual. But I did read the outline before the podcast.
I know. I was going to say it's like quite ironic.
I know. It's pretty crazy.
So sad.
So let's get into it. Let's talk about some Jedi motherfuckers, Yoda, Obi, and Luke.
And we're going to try really hard not to talk about The Last Jedi while we talk about There Is Another specifically, because, oh man, is there a lot to unpack there. So
definitely. And we'll revisit this one in our Last Jedi wrap-up, which
totally
will launch sometime after the new year. But it's... Yeah, there's... there's a lot here. I mean, even just this story. I mean, so obviously this is from Yoda's perspective on Dagobah before and around the time when Obi-Wan is killed by Darth Vader. And it's a really interesting perspective because there's two things you find out. One is that Yoda seems clear that the Jedi messed up. He seems kind of aware, but it's not clear. Like, it's like when somebody knows that they messed up, but they don't exactly know what they did. Like, I kind of get that vibe from Yoda. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I agree with that. He didn't really specify any, like, he couldn't point to any specific actions or policies or what have you having to do with the Jedi Order that brought about its downfall. But clearly they did something wrong because they got obliterated. And so that's the part that clearly he can recognize. I just...
Yeah, and yeah. So, like, he seems like on his own journey to get back in touch with the Force almost. Like, he feels like, in his own way, he's feeling kind of dejected about the Force. Like, I feel like his exile... And we don't really think about this when we watch Empire because he's Yoda and he's so wise and he's the ultimate Jedi Master. But, like, it definitely seems like his exile is affecting him just as much as Obi-Wan's exile is affecting him.
I mean, it's interesting to think about who Yoda is in the prequel trilogy to who he is in Empire because he goes batshit crazy. Like, he fully turns into bonkers-ass eccentric old man who's just, like, raiding around through Luke's stuff, like, taking his, like, food rations and throwing them, like, beating the shit out of R2 with a stick. Like, he's lost it. Like, he's still a Jedi Master and a genius, and, you know, he's 900-odd years old, so at a certain point, you know, you just are who you are, but he's kind of losing his marbles a little bit.
Well, and I'm glad you bring up his age, Kate, because I think that's a really interesting and important nuance to this, is he is kind of the longest timeline we have for the Jedi Order as kind of audience members and fans of the Star Wars saga. So not only, I mean, I think that's definitely kind of shaping what we see of him here and how he feels about kind of the downfall of the Jedi, because it's either it's been like kind of a long timeline and you know, just like slowly inching away from what it, you know, the ideals of the Jedi, or not even inching away from, but just inching away from kind of good towards something not so good that kind of, you know, we can attribute the downfall to, or something else. I mean, maybe it was, you know, as soon as we brought Anakin into the Order, everything got crazy. No, we know that's not the case, but I think it's just really interesting. I think his long perspective gives us a different perspective about how to view the downfall of the Jedi.
Totally, and Keeks, I actually want to go back to something you just said, where we know, we being the viewer, that it's not just that, oh, as soon as we brought Anakin into the Order, everything got fucked up. But if you look back at Phantom Menace and Revenge of the Sith, Attack of the Clones, you don't get so much of this. But particularly in Phantom Menace, Yoda personally is very against training Anakin as a 10-year-old. He says explicitly to Obi-Wan that I do not agree with the Council's decision, and I think this is a bad idea that will come back to bite us. And then in Revenge of the Sith, you get a lot of, we've been tricked by the Sith. This is Darth Sidious and Darth Vader's doing. You don't really get that owning of responsibility in the movies. And we don't really get a sense of it in Empire either, just because it doesn't come up. And so I feel like this story is the first place where we get inklings that Yoda understands that the Jedi had lost their way. We don't get kind of the full reckoning that, you know, maybe... you know, I think it's certainly become popular with some fan theories, but he knows, and to an extent, Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon knew when we read There Is Another and Time of Death, or sorry, not There Is Another, Master and Apprentice and Time of Death earlier in the book. They also, to a certain extent, know that the Jedi, something happened along the way, But this is the first time that we get it from Yoda, who obviously is the Jedi personified.
Like, I almost wonder in Yoda's very long life if memory just starts becoming selective just because he doesn't have that much room in his brain, you know?
That's true, and he's always meditating, right? So, and we know from meditation, he's probably seen a lot of the past, but a lot of the future, and also things that are true and things that are not true, right? And I can't imagine trying to hold all of that in my brain at once. So I think probably at a certain point, he's just like, I trust the Force with matters. Yeah. And I'm going to continue to meditate and try not to kind of like make my own decisions, but let the Force guide me.
No, totally. I think that's exactly right. Because you have... I feel like Yoda is very much the master who is most in tune with the Force. And, you know, maybe this was Qui-Gon at one point. But you have... And he even admits as much that he kind of thinks as much of himself, where he's talking to Obi-Wan's Force ghost. And Obi-Wan, like, makes some crack about how his bed is damp. And Obi-Wan is like, does dampness bother you as a ghost? And Obi-Wan's like, you'll be surprised. And Yoda's like, nothing surprises me anymore. And then Obi-Wan just kind of like smiles and says again, you'll be surprised. And it's just that interesting dichotomy of like, Yoda is so close to the Force in so many ways, and yet he still has so much left to learn. I don't know. I don't know what vehicle, what media would be good for this, but I kind of just want stories from the perspective of Force ghosts. I don't know how to, like, maybe novella would be good for that. But like, I think that the problems that kind of omniscient, kind of that omniscient point of view presents. And we got just a bare glimpse of this in Master and Apprentice by Claudia Gray earlier in the book with Qui-Gon. Is just really fascinating. We can kind of see the larger view of the Force in a way that we just by definition can't in living characters.
I just got this, like, what if they did it as, like, this weird augmented reality shit at Star Wars Land whenever the fuck they opened it? Because that would be kind of neat. But anyway.
One of your roles is the Force Ghost? That'd be amazing.
Anyway.
Just have to enter in and out of conversations at weird times. All right. And then there's also one thing that is really the big headline coming out of There Is Another. And it, because it's in the title. And it's... the bombshell, I don't know, I felt it was a bombshell, that Yoda didn't want to train Luke, ever. Yoda wanted to train Leia. When Yoda thought of The Last Jedi, to borrow the title, he thought it was Leia. And he felt very confident that it was Leia, and that she was going to be the one to bring the Jedi back.
I also wish that.
I don't know.
I'm such an asshole.
What?
I said, I'm such an asshole. Oh, I'm like, God. What about if just, like, the whole franchise was different, though? What if it was just Leia? Same Yoda.
I mean, honestly, when Chris told me what the story was about before I read it, and I actually read the story while I was sitting in line waiting to get into the theater for The Last Jedi, so my head was, like, nonstop exploding for several hours. But now that I'm, like, sitting here and thinking about it, it doesn't really surprise me that Yoda hardcore doesn't want to train Luke, because I mean, what he sees in Luke are the same, he says so, but are they the same traits that he saw in Anakin, where he was just like, gonna pass on this kid, thanks though, you know?
Yeah, right, and I feel like that's almost the remnant of what destroyed the Jedi still lurking in him, because it's that fear, right? It's that fear of what Luke could do. And it's that fear that, like, he sees the fear, and he sees the anger in Luke. And as you know, as we hear in Empire, always his mind on the future, like never on where he is or where he was, what he was doing. And I, like, in the movie, in Empire Strikes Back, obviously you kind of take that as like, oh, Yoda just like kind of being an old like curmudgeon kind of. And it, but you get the view here that like completely changes it. It's like, no, this is a long thought out opinion. I have been watching Luke and I have been watching Leia, and one of these people is fit to be a Jedi, and it is not Luke.
It's interesting, though, because, I mean, what I've been thinking about is, like, if we were in the Old Republic, right, and two Force-sensitive children were born, they would both be trained as Jedi.
Yes.
There wouldn't really be a choice at all. It's like, right. Oh, they were born Force-sensitive in the Republic? Great, they're both getting trained. Like, it wouldn't...
What a great point.
That's why I think there's this... as far as we know, right, like... That
yes.
brings up a question that is even more interesting to me. That is, like, did the Jedi High Council, like, have veto power over some kids or what?
They must have.
I mean, we know Anakin's different, blah, 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 but continue.
Right.
Sorry.
But, I mean, I feel like when... I think my opinion of this is being clouded by some fanfic I read. Like, literally, because...
That's fine, let's roll with it.
All right, sure. So the idea in that fanfic is that most of the time, when the Jedi discovered Force-sensitive kids, they were out in the field, or they got a call when they were on a mission, hey, can you, on your way home, swing by this nearby planet and see if this kid is actually Force-sensitive? And, you know, there were actually, you know, tests for that, similar to ones that Anakin received, you know, can you see... what's on the view screen, even though you're not actually looking at what the image is, sort of thing. And then the other...
What is your midichlorian count?
Yeah, sure. Yes, that's part of it, too. But also, there is also this idea that some parents would bring their kids to the temple, hoping that they would just wind up being Force-sensitive and they wouldn't have to, like... You know, it was like the Galaxy's Far, Far Away equivalent of, I don't want this kid, so I'm gonna sell them into slavery and make them an indentured servant, or sell them off as a child bride or something like that, so I don't have to feed them anymore. And so, the idea that, you know, they had to go through these tests, some of them had to have been lying about that, or, you know, even the ones who are out in the galaxy, like, oh, my kid did a weird thing one time, but that was one time, they're not actually Force-sensitive, that sort of thing. Where was I going with this? Oh yeah, you were asking if they had veto power. I assume they did. But also, the other interesting...
Oh, that's interesting, because we can come back to this, and maybe this isn't even the right podcast for it, but I don't assume that they had veto power at all. That the parents had veto power.
Oh.
No, I meant the Jedi Council had veto power.
Yeah, they must have.
The Jedi?
The Council, yeah.
Oh, the Council had veto... Oh, sorry, I misunderstood that.
No, the parents absolutely not.
Okay, yeah, no. Okay, agree.
I do think
that the council... Well, because the council vetoed Anakin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry.
Well, right, but we don't know how... I'm just wondering, like, was he the first one to do...
Right, okay.
I mean, yes, we know
gotcha,
he...
Sorry,
he,
I missed
I just mean, like,
this conversation
I mean,
somewhere and I got it.
It's okay. I'm more thinking, like, younglings. Like...
I think they must have.
More than anything else.
I think that must have happened at some point in the past. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had protocols for it.
Also, like, what were, assuming the kid is actually Force-sensitive, right? Would there be an actual reason for them to veto training the kid if he was, in fact, he or she was, in fact, Force-sensitive?
They were a giant asshole.
That's more of, like, what I was getting at.
Oh,
yeah.
Anyway.
My bad. I just went on a huge tangent. You can just delete
it. It's okay.
That.
You can always go on a huge tangent.
But not only was it long, it was also boring. No, I'm just kidding. It was great.
I am sad.
No, this, I mean, all of this is like, we don't have any information about this, right?
No, exactly.
Nor do
it's
I
all,
think we're,
it's all rampant
nor
speculation.
Do I think, are we going to get any more information about
Fuck
this
no.
specifically?
Yeah, I agree. I don't think we are.
Fuck no. We already got told that the TV show's not going to be KOTOR, so fuck it.
I was just about to make a Last Jedi. Well, it's not a Last Jedi spoiler.
No,
I was just
not.
About to mention the you-know-who at the end of the you-know-what.
Hush. Anyway.
I don't even...
Anyway.
What? So, I have a question. Yoda talks about how he missed his chance to train Leia. What was he fucking doing?
I don't know.
Like, Obi-Wan was out here trying to train Luke, and Uncle Owen wouldn't let him. That's fine. That's different. What was Yoda doing? Was Yoda trying to train Leia?
Okay. I got the feeling from the story with him ducking all of those Imperial spy droids that he literally could not leave Dagobah. And that's why he couldn't train her. Like, he needed someone to bring her to him. And, like, at the point where he can't leave his fucking house without, like, you know, hiding behind a bunch of rocks on the way to, like, go pick plants or whatever the fuck, like, at what point was he gonna get a message out to somebody being like, hey, could you get this kid for me? All right.
Yeah, that's fair.
I just want to backpedal for a second here. So, going back to Keeks, actually, your point about in the Old Republic, probably both Leia and Luke would have been trained. Why didn't they just do that? Like, why couldn't they just train both of them?
Because it's dangerous, right? I mean, like, we know that answer.
Oh.
Leia was a princess. Like, if she fucked off to Dagobah, like some other people we know, somebody would have asked where she was. Like,
and Yoda addresses that, you know what I mean? He says that, like, if Obi-Wan and him had stayed together, the Empire would have found them.
Okay.
So I mean, it's like, it's not the question I asked, but it's related in that, like, why did Yoda miss his chance to train Leia? Like, okay. Had he not missed his chance to train Leia, it feels to me like their goal initially was for them both to be trained.
Oh.
Like, from the way Yoda talks about it.
That's not what I pulled out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, from the way Yoda talks about it, I think that their initial best laid plan was for Yoda to train Leia and Obi-Wan to train Luke.
That's not what I pulled out. That's not what I saw in that.
Interesting.
It's just like, because the way, I mean, the title of the story and the way it's framed, it just seems like they had to pick one and the other one was backup or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, maybe.
Interesting.
Well, maybe the other one was backup. Maybe the other one was the contingency plan, just like Yoda alludes to in Empire, where Obi-Wan's like, that boy is our last hope. And Yoda says, no, there is another.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why Obi-Wan would even say that if the plan was always for them to both be trained.
Well, that's a great segue into our last question on this story. Why was Obi-Wan so adamant that Yoda trained Luke?
I don't know. I always felt like it was bias.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think it's bias. I think it's that he sees Anakin and Luke, and his personal judgment is clouding him.
I think he sees Anakin and Luke and wants a second chance at saving Anakin.
Agreed.
Yep. And he wants a second chance at saving Anakin, but he wants to, if he can't do that, he wants to Luke to not turn to the dark side, right? Which is, like, by proxy saving Anakin, quote unquote.
Right.
Yeah. And I think this actually really reminded me of Rebels in Twin Suns in season 3 of Rebels, where, so, and this is spoiler for Rebels season 3 if you haven't seen Twin Suns yet, but when Maul dies and is dying, and asks, is he the chosen one? Referring to Luke. And Obi-Wan says, he is. I thought that was a really interesting moment because, and this is very much something that Pablo Hidalgo addressed on Twitter. I know Kate hates going on these tangents. But basically the question
Specifically Pablo tangents.
No, exactly. The question of whether or not Luke is the chosen one. And what Pablo said, which I think makes a lot of sense, is it is very clear from the original trilogy that Obi-Wan thinks that Luke is the chosen one. Like, he makes that very clear. That boy is our last hope. Talking to Luke about when Luke says, I can't kill Darth Vader. Obi-Wan says, and the Empire has already won. To him, Luke is the chosen one. There's nothing necessarily in canon besides Obi-Wan's faith that assures us that Obi-Wan is right. Because George Lucas has also been unequivocally clear. To George Lucas, Anakin is the chosen one. So, I do think Obi-Wan is biased. I think that Obi-Wan wants Luke to be the chosen one, and that's why he wants Luke to be trained, and frankly doesn't care as much about Leia.
I have a question, though. So, really quickly, what do we think would have happened if they had trained Leia instead, if they had gone with Yoda's plan? Because I have my thoughts on this, but I wanted to get y'all's thoughts.
I actually don't think it would have gone as well as Yoda thought.
We can't do that quickly, Kate.
Oh, whatever.
It would have been different. It would have been totally fucking different. I think she would have listened to Luke. I think she would have listened to Yoda better than Luke did.
Yes. Chris, what were your...
So I'm just thinking back to our discussion of Bloodline in episodes 4 through 8 of the Book Wars pod. You should go back and listen to them. And we kind of had this discussion of who is Leia in terms, like, in relation to her parents. And we talked at that point about how Luke is Padme's son and Leia is Anakin's daughter. And while Luke definitely has that fire and that anger that Anakin had, like, there's no question about that. I also think that, because, and this is hard, right? Because Leia is this beloved character who, like, literally is the character who can do no wrong in the Star Wars universe. And rightfully so, because she's amazing. But I do worry because she does have that fiery spirit that we see in Bloodline and we see a little bit of in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. Like, I do wonder if she would be more tempted to the dark side out of a desire to fix things. Whereas Luke is kind of like, this is going to sound kind of mean, but Luke's a simple guy, right? Like, Luke
he's
wants
a
to love
boy.
Luke wants to love people and he wants to save people.
He's a really soft boy.
He's very soft. And he like
in a great way.
Like
Luke's really sheltered goals, compared to Leia. Like,
yeah,
honestly.
Absolutely. And Luke's ultimate goals are for people to love each other. Leia's ultimate goals are power related. Power related for good, don't get me wrong. But they are power related. And that makes me kind of nervous to think of her as the last hope and for her to be put in that same situation of, like, obviously she has a history with Darth Vader, but if Darth Vader says to her, "You are my daughter, together you and I can overthrow the Empire and shape the galaxy how we want it to be," does Leia turn that down?
I think she does. Okay, so here's my thoughts about if Leia had been trained instead. I think best case scenario, everything would have been mostly the same, except that I do think she would have turned him down because she hates him.
That's true. The personal experience with Darth Vader is very relevant here.
Yeah. Because she hates him because he tortured her. But, you know, supposing best case scenario, everything remains pretty much the same. I think that she kills Vader, but Vader does not turn back to the light.
That I agree with.
This all sounds correct.
I don't think that she would have any faith that Vader could be redeemed.
Oh, fuck no. I mean, and how could you blame her? You know?
And to that effect, does that balance the Force then? Like, is there balance in the Force if Vader is not redeemed?
Probably not. Because then Leia killing him out of revenge would set her down the path to the dark side.
Yeah. Exactly. I totally agree. Like, even if she doesn't turn while Vader or the Emperor are alive, I think there's the question of, say, that she, you know, through her own devious plot, gets in the throne room with the Emperor and Vader. I don't think Vader saves her, because I don't think she shows enough love for him to turn him away from the dark side, because she hates him.
Right. And, you know, we've heard it a million times. Revenge is not the Jedi way. Leia is totally a person too who would be out for revenge, which is, like, not a knock on her. I think that's, like, natural, and I would feel the same way, but
yeah,
it's Leia.
No, I think that's a fair thing to say about her character. So it's interesting because, like, A, does she even survive the confrontation with the Emperor? And B, if she does, is she able to resist the lurings of the dark side for the rest of her life? And I don't know, particularly with all the shit she's dealing with in Bloodline. Like, there's a lot that she could do with more power.
This is making my head hurt.
Yeah.
Speaking of queer.
Right. Anyway, so the next thing we want to talk about is similar to Leia. Let's talk about Mon Mothma. Because Mon Mothma is a character whose, you know, legend, as Kate writes in our outline very helpfully, whose legend has grown outside of the films because she's in Rebels, and she has the deleted scenes in Revenge of the Sith, and within the films, obviously, or outside of the Skywalker saga films, in Rogue One, she has a fairly small but major role. And we get a very different side of her in Contingency Plan by Alexander Freed.
Yes. So, kind of like Leia, Mon Mothma is always personified as being this super good, moral, upstanding character. She's the only other character, I think, in the Skywalker saga that's always... She's always dressed in white. You know, she's always, like, really pure. She's a woman, but everyone pays attention to her. Everyone follows her lead because, I mean, she's the leader of the rebellion, especially after Bail Organa dies. But we don't really get a lot of her until Return of the Jedi. And so the story kind of closes that gap. Where was she during the Battle of Yavin? And where she was going to a safe house, which, understandable, she's a leader of the rebellion. She can't die because that would leave the whole thing in chaos. But she's prepared for anything. She's prepared for any outcome. You know, if they win the Battle of Yavin, then she's got all of their data and their plans with her, and that's all good. But if they lose, she's prepared to surrender. And that was fascinating to me. So, I guess my question here, since everyone is jumping to make comments about about Mon Mothma.
I've just been talking so much. I need to stop.
You do need to stop. How long have men been talking?
Too long.
So, my question related to this, as I put on the outline. So, where is the line then for Mon Mothma, as she's depicted in the short story, between sacrifice and selfishness and heroism and cowardice?
It's so hard. That's such a hard question.
I know. Can you tell I wrote it?
Yeah, I can.
To me, this makes me think less. I mean, not less of her, like she's a bad character now, but like, I don't think that this is a positive portrayal of Mon Mothma. Like, I think part of what makes, and it's hard, right? Because, and I actually don't expect, maybe you two will, I don't necessarily expect our listeners to agree with me on this. I feel like part of being in any war, and particularly a war like the Rebellion, is about making hard choices. And Mon Mothma has drawn the line that the Empire has weapons of mass destruction. They have the ability to destroy a planet, and she is not willing to have that on her conscience. She is unwilling to have that war and the deaths of these planets on her conscience. And I get that, right? Because, and she makes a very good argument for it. She's, younger people can do what they will, and they can make their own decisions without her leading them. But I think part of leading is taking on that responsibility and not passing it on, and recognizing the truth that the ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant compared to the enslavement of the galaxy, which is what the Empire has done and continues to do. And so I don't agree with her contingency plan.
Interesting, because I thought that whole time that you were making an argument for agreeing with her contingency plan until the last second. Until like the last 15 seconds of what you said. No, I mean, that's all I was going to say is, I mean, I think it's hard to know, just because, I mean, it always, whenever we see the rebels, it always seems like they're on the brink of extinction, except for probably like Empire. It's just like, there's always like five people left. And I mean, I think I totally get what you're saying, Chris. Like, she's faced obviously with the hard choice of like planets getting annihilated versus enslavement of the entire galaxy. But at the same time, how do you like value human life over human life? You know what I mean? It's like,
yes.
six to one, half a dozen of the other. I think I think in her mind, she's saying, I'd rather them capture me and execute me than, I mean, than blow up, you know, 25 planets looking for the rebellion. You know, just picking a random number. I don't know. But I think,
no.
I don't know necessarily, I don't think that there's a right choice here, but like, can you think of a better contingency plan? I mean, I just don't know, like, what else should she be doing after the Battle of Yavin? Just, like, regrouping, trying to regroup and, like, continue the rebellion? Or are the, her, I mean, is she trying to make that choice, like, let's take a look at how depleted the resources are afterward, blah, blah, blah. Like, should I sacrifice myself so that a bunch of planets don't get blown up looking for the rebellion, or whatever the alternative is to that?
Yeah. Totally. I think, well, first of all, I think that this is going to be an interesting point to return to when we talk about The Last Jedi for hashtag reasons. My other thing is that it's interesting to note that the Rebellion has plenty of stories of heroic sacrifice. You know, we see it in the stories in this book about the pilots,
give me a description.
The leader's name, who, like, he knows the ship is going to blow up, so he sets Luke up to do the Crunch-Run.
Names are hard.
Dreis. Yes. You know, like,
Draven is the general in Rogue One. Correct. I know who people are. Don't at me.
Like, you know, he knows he's going to die, so he... you know, you have examples like Dreis, who... He knows he's going to die, so he decides to, I don't know, distract the TIE fighters a little bit and give Luke some time to set up for his trench run. You have on Rebels, in Zero Hour, the season finale for season 3, you have Jun Sato sacrificing himself, you know, to ram into a Star Destroyer so that the Rebel cell from Adelon has a chance to escape. But it's interesting to note that most of these examples that we're seeing of that kind of heroic sacrifice, that kind of heroic suicide, are dudes. And I think, actually, that that's... It's interesting to me that I'm kind of... I understand where Mon Mothma's coming from, and I know, Keeks, you do too. Like, she's being really analytical about this. Like you said, she's, like, analyzing the resources, the chances of survival for... the rebellion, for the Empire, for, and people in the galaxy who are completely divorced from this conflict. And she's, you know, she's weighed all these factors and she's made her decision. And I think that's a thing that women do. I think that's a thing in society that women do. Like, I mean, on a very small scale, you think about, no matter if you have a household, with, you know, a man and a woman running it, no matter how egalitarian the relationship is, you know, if they both work, you know, they both have equal parts in childcare, whatever, it's still a lot of the emotional and housework burden falls on the woman. She's the one who keeps track of, you know, when kids' soccer practice is and when they need groceries and exactly what groceries they need. And, you know, is it time for our heater to get inspected and that kind of thing? That's Mon Mothma. Like, she's that kind of, like, silent hero that is sitting in the background. No one stops to think, oh, you're doing all the quiet work. That without it, literally, this whole operation would fall apart. And you're not that kind of person doing this big, flashy, you know, heroic gesture or whatever.
Yeah. All right. You've mostly convinced me. I think the one thing, and maybe this is as a result of being written by a man, her line about how younger people can make their own choices if they want to continue the rebellion or not. That specific thing rubbed me the wrong way, just because that feels to me like not taking responsibility for the surrender of the rebellion, but an abdication of responsibility.
She's taking responsibility for herself.
For her own
rebellion.
She's
letting other people decide if they want this to go on. Because at the end of the day, this rebellion has to outlive her. if it's going to work.
Hmm. Interesting. I gotta sit with this.
Yeah, that's kind of how I took it. That's how kind of how I thought of it too, Kate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you're like saying all these things, and I'm like, this is why statistically most companies that have women on their boards do better, because
actually think about things.
Women get shit done.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason the Rebellion and the Resistance are run by women.
Yep, fuck yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the first thing that came up for me. It was just like, yeah, I think it's hopeful. I mean, it's hopeful. It's helpful to have kind of like both gender dynamics insofar as those exist, because society in leadership in kind of anything, I think it's like, you know, all very stereotypically men are kind of thought to be gung-ho and women are kind of thought to be a little bit more conservative and thoughtful and, you know, better at conserving resources when, you know, the men in their position otherwise wouldn't. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's very calculated. I think it's all, everything that Mon Mothma, I think this actually like fits into your station, for better or for worse, right? This didn't surprise me. It surprised me.
Totally. I agree with that.
That I will agree with. I think regardless of my opinion, and you two make very good points that I need to sit with a little bit, but regardless of my opinion on whether or not I approve isn't the right word, because Mon Mothma don't need my fucking approval, sure, but whether or not I agree with her thinking, it absolutely is on character.
For sure. Speaking of on character.
But I want to talk quickly about Han. One quick aside, it's interesting because how we've like talked in the last few episodes about like how unintentionally, because we divided these stories up pretty arbitrarily, but they have like kind of have themes, right? Like the sections kind of have themes. Like the first section was linear and like just like storytelling from different perspectives, whereas the second section was all world building, and the third section was
the first section. The theme was storytelling from different perspectives and
from a certain point of view.
Tell me more, white man.
Kate, are you familiar with the Star Wars?
Oh my god. Anyway,
that's the first section. The second section was more world building, as we talked about, with all the different perspectives of essentially the same moments on Tatooine. Third section was kind of this imperial view. And this fourth section, I feel like, is very, very character-driven, because all of our points on this outline, and we've even skipped over the Rebel pilots, which we'll talk about more in the wrap-up just because we're going to run out of time and there's a lot there. But it's all character names. It's Yoda, Obi-Wan, Mon Mothma, Han. Like, we have another one on here.
Lando,
yeah. Like,
don't forget Lando, okay?
Just like side of how
everybody always fucking forgets Lando.
Everyone forgets Lando. it's just an interesting aside on like how thematically well this book works. But anyway, back to the original point after that boring aside. I find it very telling and interesting that Lando is so confused in Charles Soule's story, The Angle. What did you guys think before I dive into my white man explainer?
I mean, it's interesting to me just because this, you know, A New Hope takes place like, what, 3 years or so before Empire Strikes Back? And in 3 years, Lando has completely turned around, is a responsible person, running Bespin, and, you know, he cuts a deal with the Empire that is shitty and winds up being shitty for a lot of our protagonists, but he's doing it because he's thinking of the people he's responsible for. And it's just like, you know, Han says it himself during Empire. He's just like, look at you, a businessman. What the fuck is this? And I just think that's so, I just need to know what happens to him in that 3 years in between the story and Empire. And like, please God, someone write me a Lando novel.
Give me a Lando everything.
I know.
Yeah, we need to know more about Lando. But it's interesting just because like, what does make Han come back? Because Lando's big driving question in The Angle is, why is Han fighting the Empire? Like, that's it. That's an objectively stupid move. Like, why is Han doing it? Because Han's not, you know, Han's brave because he'll fucking fly the Millennium Falcon, like, on the Kessel Run when he's a hunk of junk.
He'll fly it, period.
He'll fly it, period, exactly. But he's not, you know, he's not a hero. Lando makes very clear his opinion of heroes in this story. And that is a negative opinion if you haven't read it yet. And Han's not a hero. And Lando says he knows Han better than anybody, like better than like a handful of people in the world. Galaxy, excuse me. And it's interesting. So what does make Han come back?
He loves Leia, etc.
Guilt. Yeah, he wants to bone Leia. But guilt.
I mean, he definitely wants to bone Leia. There's no question about that.
I think it's guilt.
But it is, I feel like, to me, it's almost this, and this honestly might just be reading too much into it. It might be reading a very grandiose sentiment into it. But I feel like part of it is, once you get involved in this struggle for freedom that we see from the rebellion and in the galaxy, it's hard to look away. Like, you have Jin in Rogue One saying the Empire's not a problem if you don't look up. But then she ends up dragged right back into it. Because rebellions are built on hope. And I feel like Han is kind of the same way. He wasn't looking up. And then he looked up once. You know, he got onto the Death Star. He met Luke. He met Obi-Wan. He met Leia. And he tries to go back to his old life. And he can't, really.
Well, I think the trick here is that the struggle becomes personified. You know, it's not just the struggle anymore. It's, oh, I know Luke. He's a sad sack. You know, I know Leia, and she really cares about this, you know. I mean, if you think of, like, any other people who are trying to run away from this, Jin, obviously, like, I know Cassian now, and she definitely wants to bone him. But, you know, it's, you know, he gives her that whole lecture about, you know, you can't just pick and choose when you want to fight sort of thing. And that sticks with her. Or even for Kanan, like, he, you know, for who has every reason to want to strike back against the Empire because they took away everything he had. He doesn't give a flying fuck until he meets Hera. And he doesn't even, when he first joins the Ghost Crew, he's not even her partner. He's just crew. He doesn't even run missions with her. You know, it's that human connection. And Star Wars is all about human connections. Or, sometimes not humans, but, you know, interpersonal connections. And I think that's part of it. I also genuinely think he felt guilty. Like, have you seen Luke's puppy dog face? Like, oh my god.
It's yeah. He's a baby. I don't know that we ever specifically get an age for Lando. I assume that he is around the same age as Han.
And Han's 29.
I was going to say Han is around
30. Han's 29. Okay. I was just wondering how much age is playing a factor in the Lando.
Like, is Han older and he's seen the light?
No.
If anything, Lando seems older.
Lando does
feel... I meant
feel,
more...
I feel like they're very similar, but I feel like Lando might be a little bit older.
Yeah. No, I was just wondering if, like, Lando was supposed to be, like, 25, if 3 years after that, there's a big difference between 25 and 28.
What are you saying about us, Kristen?
The late 20s. I'm literally not saying anything. You guys are, like, the same age as me. I don't... but... What? You are? Aren't you guys, like, 6 months younger than me?
I'm kidding.
Oh, okay, sorry. I'm not good at reading facial expressions over the internet.
Facial expressions over the nothing?
Over sound.
Yeah, facial expressions over sound. Yeah, I was just wondering, like, if aging was playing a factor between, like, you know, young free Lando and I need to, like, buckle down and get my shit together Lando. But no, it's not. Wrong again.
All right, well, I feel like that was all we had about Lando, just kind of thinking about that and what it says about Han and Lando and the difference between them. One more quick question, and then we'll start to wrap up. Wills by Tom Engelberger. Let's bring this back to the canon discussion we had a couple episodes ago.
All right.
Sorry, you looked like you were about to say something.
No,
so
I just want to be like, Wills, LOL, this fucking story.
It's so funny.
Everyone was so fucking, like, pissed at the story because they were just like, oh, this is expected to be serious and learn about the Guardian of the Wills. And then it was, like, you know, just, like, faffing about and stuff. And it
yeah,
was
it's
hysterical.
It's a shit-eating Q&A. It's amazing.
Exactly. It's great. But no, I'm just laughing at all the people who are pissed about it because I loved it. Anyway.
I feel like it is really important, though.
Well, the question we have here is, like, what does Wills tell us about, you know, canon in general? What does that mean? And what does it mean for Star Wars? And it's, you know, it's thumbing, it's like thumbing its nose at canon. Like, canon's not really canon, right? It's flexible. Like, we would keep talking about how, you know, they just decided to uncanon all the Legends books. You know, that, you know, we were talking about Pablo and his probable idea that, you know, it's everyone's an unreliable narrator. Guess what, guys? Everyone everywhere is an unreliable narrator. This is not rocket science, but whatever. It's another one of those things, like, and also the idea of who writes history. History is taken as canon. It's not canon. Like, history is written by the winner sort of thing. It's just, I don't know. It's
who lives, who dies, who tells your story.
Chris, don't bring up Hamilton again.
Oh my god.
We've lost that
Chris,
battle
you don't
before.
Have to talk about Hamilton like literally ever, so.
It's all right. Somewhere in the world, everybody's screaming. Yeah, no, exactly. History is written by the... It's just interesting because, like, this, I mean, ignoring the fact, yes, we know it's fake and in space, but, like, if you look at Star Wars as, like, as you said, as a history, as a sequence of events that happened, or that are happening, or whatever tense you want to use, there are so many different ways to tell the story, and we happened to get the one that was serious and wanted to focus starting with Star Wars and didn't want to start talking about Maul or Ahsoka or the fucking Chewbacca Family Life Day celebrations, which was a phenomenal reference to the Star Wars holiday special.
God damn it.
Like, it's just like, this story is basically telling us canon is useless.
Yeah, it was a big old troll job. Just like everything always fucking is with fucking Star Wars.
I love Star Wars so much, guys.
Yeah, it's great. It's just like, I feel like this story is just like a great reminder that, like, I feel like anytime the fandom gets extra on Twitter, we just need to show them this story.
For real.
Like, this is the ultimate it's fake and in space story. Like, you need to chill.
BT Dubs, props for quote-unquote it's faking in space at Chaos Bria. Or
was that her that first?
That was her.
I knew I wasn't the one to come up with it. I couldn't remember who it was.
All right, it was her.
Props to at Chaos Bria.
We love her anyway.
I feel like, oh, and last, this has been a weird episode. Let's start wrapping it up. What story stood out to you all in this section?
Kristen.
Sparks that we didn't even talk about.
Yeah, we'll talk about
it. Talk about it next yeah. episode.
Yes,
but that was my favorite one.
Aww.
It was so sad.
So sad.
I know.
So sad. Now I'm sad inside. Speaking of sad stories, my favorite one from this section was definitely Grounded, because holy fuck, what an emotional roller coaster! And I'm sure we'll talk about it more next time. But just the ending where everyone's celebrating because they've won, and Case is just like, we won, but at what cost? I feel responsible for every single person who died out there. And it was like, what, 27 pilots who died? That's a lot.
Because something like that. Because it's the woman's job to keep track of it.
You're right.
Just like you said with Mon Mothma, everybody else, all the men are celebrating how excited they are. And the woman, and women presumably, but the woman who is the subject of the story is the one who has to sit back and remember all the lives that are lost.
Yep.
I just loved this whole section was so good. I like, there is another, I mean, we already talked about it for so long that I think you know that I liked it. Like, that really made my jaw drop. I really enjoyed Sparks as well. And Grounded as well, honestly. Like, they were all great. I also liked the one, and I'm blanking on the name, but the one with Fake Wedge.
Oh, Duty Roster?
Duty Roster. Thank you, by Jason Fry.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
That one was just very unexpected and fun.
I laughed really hard because That guy, honest to God, looks like Wedge. And I always thought so when I was a kid. I was like, who is that? Like, oh yeah, my God. Totally. Anyway.
All right. Well, I feel like our like false starts recording this episode and the technical issues and not being able to hear each other turned this into a weird episode. So we'll wrap it up here.
Woo! This has been another weird episode of the Book Wars Pod. Thank you for listening.
Hopefully, for episode 32, our internet's working better. But in the meantime, we will next be finishing up From a Certain Point of View, wrapping it up, talking. We didn't get to talk about any of the pilot stories this time. We're going to talk about that next time. We're going to talk about how this changes our view of watching Star Wars as a whole, some of the advantages of short stories, all that good stuff. So don't miss it. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, email. You know them all, but Book Wars Pod on all those things, bookwarspod@gmail.com over email. Rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. We're going to start saying this at the top of the show too, if I remember, because we need more ratings and reviews and subscriptions on iTunes. It's the best way to get people to discover the show. They're all going to come and rant to us about Last Jedi, and then we're going to yell at them.
I love yelling.
We sure do.
Yeah.
I'm TBH impressed that Kate held together with how much vodka she put in her drink.
I'm drinking slowly.
Are you drinking? All right,
fair.
I'm gonna be the one
who gets to reap the rewards after we're done. Got it.
Well, I was gonna say I'm probably gonna be drunk during the wrap up because I didn't eat enough. So you're welcome.
Hey Chris, go fuck yourself.
Yep. And on that note, our theme song is Whiz Bang by Poddington Bear. Our logo and artwork are by Joby Tire Design. For Kate and Kristen, thank you for listening to episode 31 of the Book Wars Pod, and we'll talk to you next week.
Fucking technology, Jesus Lord.